can roll tape, got to say that. The title of this session today is Doing More and Enjoying It Less. It's the first session of a series this week that the long title for is In Search of an Undivided Life in a Divided World. And what I thought I'd do first is just kind of outline what the sessions will be, because really today is sort of the first part in a two-part talk. Today, doing more, enjoying it less, and tomorrow, finding spirituality in the active life. So we're going to kind of focus today on why we feel it is that we're doing more these days and enjoying it less, and what some of the problems are, and then tomorrow focus in on, is it possible to have a full active life and have that life be satisfying and spiritual. On Wednesday, all my titles were too long to fit on the board, so I'll give you a long title. I think the board says pluralism, relativism, and nihilism, and what I want to talk about there is dealing with the isms of our time. Pluralism being the idea that we have many and varying viewpoints, and especially as our world becomes closer with advanced technology, communication, and travel, we have even more diversity of viewpoints to consider. And then the reaction by some to that, of a relativistic reaction, that while there is no way to prove that one view is better than another, we have all these conflicting views, how do we prove that one is better than the other? And if we can't prove it objectively, then is there any reason to believe in anything at all? And talk about nihilism and where that shows up in our society, and the view that maybe anything goes, or it doesn't matter if anything goes, because we can't find our way to a right answer. And then Friday, I'd like to talk about Christian decision making and bring some material to share with you on some guidelines for finding some kind of congruity and patterns in the kind of busy, hectic lives that we lead, and some ways in which maybe we can find some focus in making decisions as Christians. So on to today's topic. First, I thought I'd tell you a little bit why I picked this topic. Several reasons. One, I'm a lawyer, and I've just recently completed a period of time in full-time practice of law. I now teach law school full-time and practice a little bit part-time. But what I perceived at in the profession was a real dissatisfaction on the part of people with what they were doing. They'd spend years training to do this, and then they go out into the world and they're really pretty unhappy doing it. And I talked to people, I remember my own feelings of frustration, and they said, well, the only thing that's important is how many hours I bill. And to be a good attorney, then that's all I have time for, is to just, you know, that's the message I'm getting from the firm. That's the message, you know, that we seem to get from society. And I don't think that this is a phenomenon that's limited to the practice of law. I think that a lot of people feel that we have our public life, our work life, and we have our private life. And then in some ways, the two don't mix. And that when we're in our public sphere, we have to pretend like that's all we are, and that we're totally devoted to that, to the exclusion of family. And then when we turn to the private sphere, we talk about quality time. Well, we don't have quantity time, so let's try to spend some of that quality time with each other and make up for the fact that we're running everywhere doing all sorts of stuff. I saw a special on television several months ago, about 1 o'clock in the morning. I was folding laundry, you know, got down to that point in the to-do list, and this special was on the South American hummingbird. And they told a story about this little hummingbird that beats its wings thousands of times a minute. And it has to beat its wings that fast in order to hover properly to collect nectar from flowers. And the irony is that it takes so much energy to do that, that it has to collect nectar all day long in order to beat its wings that fast. It has to beat its wings that fast in order to collect nectar all day long. I thought, that's me. That's me that they're talking about there. That's how I feel every day. But then there came the real rub. And that is that these hummingbirds, they're so tired at the end of the day that they go into the state of hibernation. At night, their body temperature cools way down. And so it's deeper than even really a sleep. And at night, after that happens, there is a flower that's indigenous to the area that only opens at night. And this flower just drips with nectar. I mean, this hummingbird, you get enough nectar off this one flower, you know, that it takes all day to accumulate. And then who gets the nectar off that flower? Well, there's a bat that sleeps all day, comes and wakes up at night, swoops in, and drinks up this nectar. So I thought, well, you know, there might be a moral in this story somewhere. Maybe I'd like to think about that a little bit. So I offer that as just kind of an opening metaphor to think about, and we maybe will refer back to that. And please feel free to refer back to that with your own opinions and ideas. I hope that we can have some fun with this week and kind of share our mutual frustrations and maybe some of our inspirations as well as how we can deal with this problem. I'd like to start out by getting your ideas of why it seems like we're doing more. I've talked to enough people to think that I'm not the only one that feels that way. So if you feel like you're busier now than you used to be, or you think that we're busier in these times than we were, you know, several decades ago, can you think of any reasons for that?
I think one of the big reasons is a lot of families have both members working, and that really restricts the economy.
Okay, we'll say two-income families or multiple. Okay.
There's really a lot more opportunities available. A lot more choices.
Okay, anybody else just speak up. I won't write as quickly as you can talk.
Large organizations are trying to skinny down on the people, but they don't stop the workload.
Okay. They reduce the workforce, maintain output.
Society has become more complex.
Okay. Society more complex. I could add a comment there. I think that in my own profession, the advent of the fax machine and express overnight mail and all that sort of thing. I've heard, you know, as they put pressure on young attorneys for how productive they should be, the judge that I worked for right out of law school, who's in his 70s, said, you know, he said that these big attorney mills, they talk about what it is to practice law and what it was in their day, but he said, you know, we didn't have fax machines, we didn't have Federal Express, and he said, you know, that 3 to 5 day mail turnaround time was something that you counted on, you know. You waited for something to arrive in the mail, you had some time to think about it, and now a client will call, and as they're talking to you on the phone, they say, well, my secretary is faxing the contract. Why don't you just have your secretary bring it in, and we'll just go over it on the phone here, and you can tell me what you think.
Mark. I think that's right. I think that you should list technology separately, because okay. I find in my office, all the things that are allegedly designed to save time make you spend a lot more. Phone mail is an example. People used to call and you weren't in, and they used to think, oh, well, it wasn't that important anyway. Now they leave a message on phone mail, so then you have to answer.
And you feel obligated to answer.
Call them.
That's right.
So I think technology actually makes you work harder.
I think what I'll do after 2 weeks at Holden is I'll walk in the house and just throw the answering machine in the waste basket and tell people, oh, I'm sorry, I came home, it was broken, what can I tell you? You know, I fear that as much as anything on the return trip. Okay, anybody else?
Yeah, I think one that kind of technology feeds this societal attitude that you are valued by how busy you are and how much you do. And if you waste your time driving in the car listening to music instead of working on the car phone, you you are not as valuable a person.
Right. We all try to outdo each other with busy-izing, you know? It's like telling one another just how busy we are. An interesting comment from someone who is from Europe, and they say, you know, it would be considered extremely passé to say there that you're busy, you know? But that is something that people just wouldn't say to each other. But just how often do you hear that? I'd say in a week's time, but for me, I'd say in a day's time. You know, people saying, I'm just so busy. I'm guilty of it. People call up and want you to do something. Oh, I'd love to, but you know, I'm just so busy.
Parents start this out very young with their children, feeling that they've got to get into everything, sports, drama, so that mothers are running all hours of the day and night to get into everything they can.
So I'm going to put this down, expectations. We'll say expectations of others.
24-hour things. There's 24-hour shopping, 24-hour laundry. You know, I don't know what that would go over.
Okay. I'd like to say abusive conveniences.
Because, I mean, I know so many people who eat right here, or who work right during their lunch hour, you know, and, like, here it's nice you got this coffee hour, and then we can work, you know, that's just,
okay.
You know, do that. And I think there's other, you know, countries that have tea time and, you know, times that are just set aside for not...
Now recognize, put official...
And I fear if we had that, we'd still work right through it.
Well, when I've been practicing in Indianapolis, Indiana. When I moved back to Northwest Indiana, I joined a small firm, and that was a new experience for me. There were only three other attorneys, and so along about the first or second day, I thought it was kind of unusual. No one had invited me to go to lunch or anything, and so finally I said, well, you know, what do you folks do at, you know, for lunch? Do you go out once or twice a week? And they kind of looked at me like, you know, I was speaking a foreign language. And they said, well, that's why we have the kitchen facility here, so we can bring food from home. We don't even have to take time, you know, to go out and pick up food. So in that office, leaving the office to even get a sandwich was considered, you know, probably taking vacation time. we have offices that have really taken that. You know, I heard the one say, well, you know, I read somewhere that if you eat lunch in every day that you save 30 days a year. Yeah. It's like, save them for what? You know, so you can eat lunch in a few more times. I don't know. Okay, anything else you can think of?
I think because of situations like that where we don't properly take care of our bodies, either regeneration, rest, or eating properly, then we have this general overall feeling of not getting enough done or feeling like something's slipping by.
Okay. Yeah, I think that in some ways we're not as efficient as we could be because...
Kind of like a hummingbird.
That's right. A question mark. If we're worn out. Sometimes we spend as much time thinking about what it is we have to do, but we're so overwhelmed by it all as we do doing it. Well, I'd like to share with you a Taoist poem from Parker Palmer's book, The Active Life. And I asked the book center here to order some copies of this, so if you're interested in obtaining a copy, there are a few copies up there. And some of the things that we'll be talking about this week, I'll draw from his work. Okay, this was written many, many years ago. We'll see how it's been translated and modified somewhat for purposes of inclusive language, but past that, it's pretty much true to the original. It's called The Active Life, written by Shuang Tzu. If an expert does not have some problem to vex him, he is unhappy. If a philosopher's teaching is never attacked, she pines away. If critics have no one on whom to exercise their spite, they are unhappy. All such people are prisoners in the world of objects. He who wants followers seeks political power. She who wants reputation holds an office. The strong man looks for weights to lift. The brave woman looks for an emergency in which she can show bravery. The swordsman wants a battle in which he can swing a sword. People past their prime prefer a dignified retirement in which they may seem profound. People experienced in law seek difficult cases to extend the application of laws. Liturgists and musicians like festivals in which they can parade their ceremonious talents. The benevolent, the dutiful, are always looking for chances to display virtue. Where would the gardener be if there were no more weeds? What would become of business without a market of fools? Where would the masses be if there were no protests for getting jammed together and making noise? What would become of labor if there were no superfluous objects to be made? Produce, get results, make money, make friends, make changes, or you will die of despair. Those who are caught in the machinery of power take no joy except in activity and change, the whirring of the machine. Whenever an occasion for action presents itself, they are compelled to act. They cannot help themselves. They are inexorably moved, like the machine of which they are a part. Prisoners in the world of objects, they have no choice but to submit to the demands of matter. They are pressed down and crushed by external forces, fashion, the market, events, public opinion. Never in a whole lifetime do they recover their right mind. The active life, what a pity. Sounds like it could have been written yesterday, doesn't it? Any responses to that? I know it's hard when you're just hearing it, and I have it in print in front of me, but anything in particular strike you from that poem?
I think initially when you started out by saying there was some point where you talked about the possessions or things. At about the instant you said that, I realized I was holding my son. He was content with one toy, but we gave him another because the one was rattled. So now he had a choice to make. Do I want to play with the one or do I want to play with the other?
All such people are prisoners in the world of objects. That might have been the line. Okay.
I mean, the thing that brought to my mind that's not mentioned here is we all work so much more because there are so many things that we want.
Yeah. Find what I did with my shock here.
It's right
there we go. Yes. It's such a large piece, I don't know how I missed it. Okay. I was struck, somewhat dumbfounded, when my daughter was in the first grade, and well, I don't know what I was looking in a catalog for. She looked at me and said, "Well, Mom," she said, "do we really need that?" I said, "Well, I guess it depends on what you mean by need." And she says, "Well," she said, "I think we'd be a lot better off if we lived according to our needs and not our wants." So we put the catalog down and look at that. But that, I think you're right. I think that's a real catalyst to some of our busyness. Okay, any other thoughts that you'd like to share on your reactions to that?
Well, a lot of this, I think, is driven by media and all the news that we hear about our economy. This more to have more that we want. We know that we've had recession. Well, why do we have recession? Well, because people aren't buying things. Why are people not buying things? Well, I believe that they probably already have enough. But if we don't buy some more, then the recession deepens instead of, the media just kind of, it doesn't really matter which section of the newspaper you look at. The advertising will try to get you to buy. If you read the business page, it'll tell you how gloomy things are, so you better decide to need a new refrigerator so their number of durable goods can go up. All of America is driven by this more and more.
Yeah, in fact, when you
when
talk...
we really have enough.
Talk about the recession, I remember a comment that someone made to me about, I guess it was probably about a year ago. I kind of lost track of the timing. It seems like that's when we're starting to feel that crunch. You know, businesses were doing a lot of frequent sales, and this person said, you know, they said, I've never been in a position before to take advantage of a recession, but you know, right now we're doing pretty well, and it's great to go into these sales and just really, you know, clean up. Take advantage of them. So, you know, there's both extremes on that, I think. Those that aren't buying because they maybe have enough, and those that buy a little more because now it's less expensive at somebody else's expense. Okay, before we pursue some of this a little more and talk about this poem, The Act of Life, one of the things that I'd like to offer for your consideration, and it'll be sort of a framework for today and tomorrow, something that Palmer says about this idea of, you know, which is the better way to live, the contemplative life or the active life. You know, is an active life necessarily bad? Is the question that he poses. And what he suggests is that rather than being mutually exclusive opposites, contemplation and action, they're really polar ends of a great paradox that we have to somehow keep in balance. He talks about his own spiritual journey and the fact that he's tried at times to withdraw from society. He's lived in, you know, intentional contemplative communities. And what he's found is that just by nature, he is really an active person. He enjoys the unexpected. He enjoys adventure, taking risks, and the spiritual elements that can come from a life lived actively. But that's not the kind of life that Sue is talking about in this poem, The Active Life. This life that he's described and that we've really talked about here is really more a life of frenzy. But then Palmer suggests on the other end, contemplation, if taken too far, is really a life of escapism. If that's all it is. And so, just as we start to think about this, you know, just see if that has any meaning for you to think about things in terms of this sort of paradox with escapism being on the extreme end, on the one side, and frenzy being on the other. And as we sort of work through some of these ideas, if that has any particular import for you. Well, from this, on the basis of this poem and some things that I've been throwing in a file drawer now for a couple of years, and some of the things that Palmer talks about, I thought we might go through a checklist now to look at these kinds of actions that we're involved in and why we might not be enjoying it. We've talked now about the doing more side of it. Now I really want to talk about the enjoying it less. So I wish I had another blackboard so I wouldn't have to erase this. But well, it's full. That's the do not erase side. Okay, while I'm erasing here, if you could come up with some ideas of why you think we're enjoying it less. What about what we're doing makes it less enjoyable? Well, we had one here that I think really fits both why we're doing more and why we're enjoying it less, and that was expectations of others as a motivation for why we're acting. Anybody here ever done something because somebody else expected you to, or because you wanted to?
I think that you enjoy doing different things, it kind of feeds yourself to want to do more different things. Mm-hmm. There's some enjoyment of experiencing new and different things. So you want to buy a boat, and you want to buy golf boats, and you want to buy ski gear, and you enjoy that. You kind of get into this snowball of getting more and more and more.
Okay. But you're saying, though, that you enjoy getting more.
I'm enjoying it.
Okay.
Some new things.
Okay. So that part of having more isn't necessarily, it's not necessarily a cause and effect that having more is enjoying it less. Okay.
I think a lot of the things that we're doing, though, we're not being active because we're enjoying being active. We're always doing something to accomplish. And it's always with the idea of getting this done and moving on to something else.
Okay.
It's not just being active because we enjoy what we're doing.
Yeah. We want results. We're goal-driven. We look to the utility of what's being done. Right, it doesn't matter if we enjoy it, it's just it doesn't have value. Okay. Anybody else have any?
I think you're physically tired when you're on busy lifestyle too.
So we're
and you're
suffering from
you can't enjoy
exhaustion.
You should enjoy
physical, and anybody want to put
mental
or emotional up there too? Sure. More in that world of objects. People have become objects. And, you know, one of the points that Palmer makes is anytime that we objectify the other, and he would expand it to include what we normally think of as objects. He would include nature. Anytime that we objectify the natural resources that we have, anytime that we objectify people, that we diminish our possibilities for relationship with that other as being a component of activity. Okay.
We're pretty trapped in the kind of world at home. If you don't buy all this stuff, then you're considered a loser. You know, if you don't have all the, you know, the fax machine, you're behind in time. If you don't have clothes that are up to date, you're behind the times, you know. And everything is set up that way. I mean, you find a pair of pants that you like, you know, 3 months later, they don't make them anymore, you know.
Because you're not supposed to like them anymore.
Yeah.
That's right. You're supposed to like
thing,
something else.
The same thing goes with just everything, cars, appliances, mm-hmm. you know. You get something you like. I mean, how many people can't fix a car anymore? Because, you know, they got all this computerized.
Right. I think an interesting connection between a lot of the reasons we have up here why we're enjoying what we're doing less, I think fit under what Palmer talks about as being, we're not living active lives, we're living reactive lives. And our actions don't flow so much from an internal sense of freedom, but from external provocation, i.e. the expectations of other, the results that we're trying to get, society's pressure not to be a loser, that kind of thing. And that if we go back to the poem for a minute, you know, he suggests that another way in which we do that is that we seek out situations that will trigger our favorite reactions. Okay, the brave woman looks for an emergency in which she can show bravery. You know, he who wants a reputation holds office. A swordsman wants a battle in which he can swing a sword. You know, those are examples of ways in which maybe we're doing things that we don't have to do. We're looking for the opportunity to do them. He talks about, you know, the brave woman looking for an emergency in which she can show bravery. When I worked in Indianapolis, there was a secretary in the building. I won't say any more than that, so we'll keep it anonymous. But a friend of mine, an attorney, worked in this other office, and they had what they called the calamity of the day. Because this woman was an expert at awfulizing. You know, every day there was a crisis. And every day it gave her the opportunity to save the day, to somehow, you know, come through with a solution to save the crisis. And, you know, when you think about that, I think to some extent, I know I'm guilty of that at times in my life, and I hear a lot of awfulizing going on out in the world. So, you know, maybe to a certain extent we live with some self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, he uses the example of a bank run. If the rumor starts the bank is going to run to the bank and withdraws their money, the bank's going to go under. So there may be a certain amount of that. Do you see any other connection between this being results-oriented or, you know, defining ourselves by what we do?
I think that the examples they use in the book, and we do the things that we are. I am this, so I must look for this activity to reinforce who I am. Where we find our identity, if within ourselves we are a certain something, then I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing. If indeed you are this, then you do the things that mm-hmm. you are, lean toward that. But I think the problem runs into trying to be something that you're not, or you fit a mold, so my title is this, so I must do this thing.
And what happens if somebody takes away that title, or that thing that you're doing you can no longer do, it's been taken away? What happens?
You lost your identity.
Yeah, we don't have, you know, the chronic problem that seems to run throughout, you know, this phenomenon is that we don't have any sort of self-sustaining identity. And so if we're really tied to what it is we're doing, then if you take that away, we're very unhappy. So some of this enjoying it less, I think, comes from, you know, maybe not being able to do those things that, you know, we incorporate in our identity. And then the consequence, if we've lived that active life, and, you know, retirement. I mean, we've abolished mandatory retirement in most cases. Tenured professors is an exception, and maybe there's some merit in that. I don't know. You can still mandatory retire. But in most cases, and judges. You know, you can, mandatory retirement is gone, but, you know, back when it was like you hit 70 and you're automatically out of here, if somebody's lived a life, it's really defined by what it is they do. What do they do on the day that they're 70 in one day, in 2 days, in 3 days? And how do they find their enjoyment if that's how they've been geared? I'd like to talk for a minute, too, a little bit more about some of the professions. Sue talks about some of them in kind of generic terms. But I think sometimes we're guilty in professions of creating our own work for the same reason. If we are what we do, then we better make sure that we have that thing to do. And if there's not enough of it to do, then we'll find a way to create more. And think about it. You know, I'll use my own profession as an example. There are times that attorneys, you know, think of protections that maybe people need. And last week, several people asked me what I thought about living trust. This idea that you put everything you have into a revocable trust so that you avoid probate and you avoid guardianship. And that's a legitimate mechanism for doing those things. However, it's not right for everybody. It's not like having a last will and testament. You know, they say everybody ought to have a last will and testament, and I think in most cases that is true. But I wouldn't say that if the same holds true for living trust, but how many have you seen those advertised, you know, and I hear so many people who feel that if they don't have one, that they're behind the times, that they're not protected, that something is wrong, and there are other alternative ways, probably less expensive ways, of achieving the same objectives. So, as unattractive as it is to say about my own profession, I somehow suspect that this may have been a mechanism for this, you know, self-propagation of what it is that we do. by making people think that they need what we have to offer. Can you think of any other examples? Other professions? You want to pick on lawyers, that's okay. Ways that we do it in our own lives.
Well, lawyers have started advertising now. And I don't mean to pick on you, but common terminology is ambulance chasers.
Mm-hmm.
They go out after accident cases.
You know, that is a common phenomenon that that attorneys are advertising more, and that's, I think it's a result of many things. You know, one is the economic pressure. There are a lot of lawyers and a lot of competition for the market of work. And I think that it may create work, too. I mean, if you say, well, there's a constant level of work out there, and that's just a means of tapping into it, you know, that would be one view on it. Another view would be that, well, there might be people that have received some slight injury. They slipped and fell at the grocery store or whatever, and they see an advertisement that says, you know, you've been injured? You think it's a small injury? Well, come and see me, because maybe you have legal rights that you haven't even thought about. To that extent, it may be creating work.
I think that the whole insurance, have to have insurance so I don't get sued for something that might perhaps under some remote chance happen, and the whole malpractice issue has caused a lot of financial crisis in the medical field and just with the cost of insurance in general. I don't know if that's propagated by attorneys, but it seems to be kind of a vicious cycle.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's a certain amount of, I mean, we'll give me a chance to turn the spotlight off of my profession onto another. We'll look at the medical profession for a moment. With insurances and the availability of third-party payors, I think there are more tests being done, and they're being done for a lot of reasons. Some of them legitimate, some of them because the medical profession is concerned about being sued if there's a test that's available out there and they haven't used it and they do it. But the other is that there might be a third-party payor that will pay for it. So why not order it? I mean, that boosts the income. So.
Mm-hmm. I work in the banking industry, and the phenomenon I'm sure a lot of you probably run into, you get mail, junk mail from various companies, and you wonder how they got your name. You know, you subscribe to a certain type of magazine, and all of a sudden you get mail on that. Well, in banking, what they do, they have a computer that kicks in at a certain point, give a loan, and they can tie into credit bureau reports and that sort of thing. And at a certain level, then they start sending you mail about pre-approved loan or what have you. And they target things quite well so that you get the feeling almost that you're obligated to take this money. It's there for the asking.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that starts a series of economic problems from time to time. I mean, it's great to know that it's available, and if you want it, as you said, in the legal profession, maybe you have a small injury, and then an advertiser comes, well, maybe I should do something about this after all. You know, maybe you're doing fine financially, all of a sudden the carrot's down in front of your face. Well, maybe a little bit more money would be nice for that repair that we're going to do a year from now to save the money. And I think that society tends to, our merchandisers tend to push things upon us that we really don't need anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're right. That's kind of ties in with the media blitz aspect as well. Well, let's take the flip side of this. I mean, we've talked a little bit about how maybe, you know, people are creating things that you don't need and you know, kind of bordering on exploitation. What about do-gooders? Is there ever a problem with creating activity? I mean, is doing good always good?
I'm a gymnasium counselor, and we can see every child that breaks the law as a criminal in need of all kinds of services, or you can see children make mistakes and trying to grow up, and most of them at some point or other are going to make some mistake that's criminal in nature, but hardly in need of all of the mm-hmm. services that we have to offer.
Yeah, do we sometimes rescue people that either don't need to be rescued or they don't want to be rescued? And is that, you know, is that a spiritually right action, you know, on our part to force what we perceive as the good on somebody else. And that's something that I want to talk about a little bit more tomorrow. But Palmer cites another parable from Eastern culture about a monk that's walking along, a very wise man, supposedly, and a flood is coming and there's a scorpion, you know, down by the tree. So he decides he's going to save the scorpion, and every time he reaches down to grab the scorpion, it stings him. And this happens over and over again, you know. Well, what are we to conclude from that story? That, well, it was great that, you know, no matter how difficult it was, that he kept trying and trying to, you know, to save the scorpion, or maybe it was the scorpion saying, I don't want to be saved, you know, leave me alone. You know, I think as we have people who awfulize in our society, we also have people that just love to be martyrs, you know, that just love to do things for other people, whether they want them done or not. And then, you know, get kind of pumped up about it. So I think that's any thoughts on that? Anybody see that in their lives? You don't have to name names. Well, I'll ask again. Any other thoughts on why we don't enjoy what it is we do? Think about some of the things that motivate us to act. Got external provocation, expectations of others.
I'm a teacher, and in the teaching profession, so far in my experience, I've worked in a very rural community, and now I work in a kind of urban to suburban, probably top 10 socioeconomic level. And I'm noticing with the expectations of others how much higher my stress level is, because I'm trying so hard to make sure everything's perfect at this level, because I'm so afraid someone's going to holler at me. You know? Some parent's going to come in and just be all over me. And when I was over here at this with the rural community, I mean, it was enough to walk into the school that they, you know, they trusted me. And here it's like so much energy put out to make sure everything's perfect. And I can't see it.
I think that's a big one. Fear of failure. The fear that somebody's going to come in and holler at you.
And the problem is that they do in this community.
Well, yeah,
I guess I don't like that, the fear of failure, because she hasn't failed.
I just never feel like what I'm doing is good enough.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, I feel like that if I do something really good, then they just want me to do something even better.
Or you just didn't do what they thought you should do.
That's right.
And they were vocal enough about it.
You know, and it's almost like as if you know, you know, as if you know exactly what needs to be done in the classroom. You know, half time I just want to say, who teaches them?
And that's, you know, an interesting, you said, you know, you don't like that word. And I think that's, you know, we do have all sorts of connotations about failure. And, you know, it starts out with, I remember my grade school principal used to hound us about not forgetting our books. And he said, if you forget your book, forget starts with an F, and that's what you'll get. Well, I'll never forget the day that I forgot my spelling book and, you know, was ready to toss my lunch at school because I thought my career was over. Because, boy, forget starts with F, and that's what I don't get. And we start very early on impressing people that, you know, don't take any risks, you know. Don't try something that might not meet with the expectations of others. Don't try something that has a chance of not getting the results that you're after, because we're going to consider that a failure, and failure is bad. And tomorrow there's a story that we'll talk about that deals with that issue. And, you know, maybe we're looking at failure the wrong way, and maybe we're cutting ourselves off from more enjoyable action and more opportunities in life because, you know, we're so constrained by, you know, what others think, and this fear that what we're doing will not be met with approval. I mean, I still, all these many years later, occasionally have one of these crazy exam dreams. I don't know if anybody here, you know, it's finals, and you realize you have to take this test, and you never went to the class. How did I forget? You know? What will happen to you know, you don't show up for garbology, and your name is called. Just did garbology this morning. So. Okay. So anybody that want to say anything more about this failure aspect, that is something that I do want to talk about more tomorrow as well, but there's nothing.
You mentioned the word, but the God we're worshiping means success. We haven't used the word success, but there's this nebulous thing called success, and there are books even on moving forward to excellence, you know.
And tying excellence, I think, to results as well. I mean, something is excellent, we have to be able to quantify it somehow. And if we can't quantify it, then, you know, maybe it's not very valuable. Last Saturday, when I was doing the final series on taking care of the elderly in our society, we were talking about ways of redefining responsibility. I said, you know, part of the problem is that we look at raising children or taking care of those who are aged, dependent, ill, whatever. That's kind of dirty work. And there are, you know, a number of feminists that say, you know, here, you know, this is a tough job and it falls only on women, and this is a real problem. And I'm not going to disagree that there is, you know, there needs to be some redistribution, but I think the real problem is how we're looking at the task at hand, is that we have this problem of considering it dirty work, or that it's either not valued or undervalued. You know, when was the last time that society said, boy, you know, we think you're a great person because you raised really well-adjusted children, or we think you're a great person because that you're a success because you saw to it that your elderly parents or grandparents had a good quality of life when they were in need. So we do have that problem as well.
It's almost the opposite. People will choose to spend their money on their parents or something when they get old or do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll hear them say, well, he could have been a success in this, but he chose to spend his money or spend his time or do spend more time
right.
at the office.
Right.
He could have been a real success, but he didn't.
And there's that kind of productive consumption cycle, and if an activity doesn't fit into production or consumption, well, you know, then it's kind of one of those things that we don't value. One of the things that I thought was of some interest, I usually don't read these magazines too much on airplanes, but there happened to be a good article, it's called The Juggling Act on Family and Time Management in the 90s. And something that I thought was sort of encouraging was the fact that now employers are finding that there might be a connection between happiness in the private sphere and the importance of tending to these relationship needs and productivity. And so we have a company, just read a little bit to you. It says, many business policymakers now understand that a happy employee is also a productive one. While some large corporations, including IBM, Citicorp, and Xerox, are now helping families in a variety of ways, a small Chicago company is a leader in this area. Felpro Inc., a manufacturer of engine gaskets with 2,000 employees, offers on-site child care, parental leave to care for family members, an elder care service providing daycare for dependent parents, And it also offers a summer day camp, summer jobs, scholarships, and tutoring for employees' children. It says, by freeing parents from the worries of family pressures, our employees have become more productive. There's less absenteeism, reduced turnover, an improved frame of mind, and fewer errors. We find that we are saving money by implementing these policies. So the motive may not be quite what we're talking about here, but interesting that there is this congruence between living more of a whole life and also fitting this model with, you know, what makes for a good company and a well-run company. That happy, well-rounded people are also better employees. So it might be something that we'll come back to and explore a little bit more. Well, the last one on my list that I wanted to talk about today and to get your reactions is this idea that we make a life for ourselves. And in the, in the poem that I read, he talked about make friends, let's see here, produce, get results, make money, make friends, make changes. And part of how we define the action that we take is this emphasis that we make it, that we're in control. You know, that we talk about we make peace, we make war, we make love, we make products. We talk about making or breaking a situation. What do you think about that? Is that good? I mean, is it good to be, you know, what's the difference between that and saying that we're self-actualized? You know, I think a lot of people equate those two things. People go to assertiveness seminars, presume so that they can make decisions and make situations more follow the way that they'd like them to go. Do you think of any downside to taking that approach to life? We want to control or direct what we do.
Well, then we not only get the successes, but we have to deal with all the failures because there are still.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's pretty
heavy load. Yeah, we also become the citizens for blame if what we've made doesn't turn out very well. Well, I wonder if by making, you know, proceeding on the philosophy that we're making our lives, if we don't miss out on some opportunities. If we make a product, if we make relationships, if we make friends, doesn't that kind of diminish the other in the equation? You know, again, it kind of goes back to any time that you force your will on somebody or something else, you know, you've taken away their freedom of action and you're controlling the situation. I think it also suggests that maybe this exhaustion that we feel is that we take on the responsibilities then of other people. If we consider that a situation is ours to make or break, and we then become responsible, you know, we can say, well, I'm now responsible for this person's happiness, and I'm responsible for whether or not this deal happens. You know, it's a trap that I think I've fallen into at times in the practice of law. You know, I have clients that get themselves into a real mess, and then I, you know, am called upon to help them dig out, and somewhere along the line, I all of a sudden think it's my mess, and that somehow I'm responsible for it, and if it doesn't look like there's a good solution, that's my failure. And that's a real stressful, you know, state to be in until I step back and I say, wait a minute, you know, I didn't make this deal, I didn't breach the contract, I can only do the best I can with what's been given to me. And so I don't know, what, any thoughts on that? Anybody experience that in their jobs or family lives?
Yeah, I, as a high school counselor, I
a lot of referrals from teachers of students that are problematic. You know, you say, well, I sent him to you, and he's still doing it. I didn't make him over, I didn't fix it, you know, I didn't change the kid, and he talked to me twice, I can't understand. You know, it's real easy to say, you know, I'll just send him back, you know, we will have it all.
Mm-hmm. We'll send him down to Mayor Bell again and see if we can fix him this time around. Right. Yeah, I think that there's a whole dimension to our relationships and the activity that we're involved in that we foreclose when, you know, we not only think that we can make or break a situation, but it's our responsibility to, and that there's a whole other side of exploring the other elements in the activity to find out what sort of freedom might come from that to come up with some other solutions. An area that I've been interested in for a few years now is called neuro-linguistic programming. I don't know if anybody heard of NLP. And I attended a seminar last fall on problem solving and the benefits of increasing the problem solving surface. You know, when people sit down to negotiate something or to brainstorm to solve a problem, we identify what all the elements are, and then like a jigsaw puzzle, you know, we sit and try to force these pieces together to see if we can't come up with a solution, and then, you know, we either give up or come up with the best that we can within the parameters. And, you know, one of the techniques that they talked about in this program was stepping back from it and seeing if there isn't some way that you can expand the problem-solving surface. And so that you can expand the kinds of alternatives. And sometimes a way to do that is instead of assuming what other people are interested in a situation, that you step back and find out more. And, you know, listen to the other and sit back and try to take in that information. And that's really where I'd like to pick up tomorrow, is to talk about the nature of activity itself and how we can find ways of making what we do, oh, I use that word, making, of finding ways so that what we do is more enjoyable and we see more possibilities. Because we're always going to have situations where we do have to respond to the command of another. It may not even be as subtle as an expectation. It may be a command. A boss may say, this is your task to complete, you know. But what I'd like to offer for your consideration tomorrow, among some other things, is that there may be more freedom in how we complete that than what we sometimes allow ourselves to think.
A thought that comes to mind, too, in that in a lot of the situations we run into are dealing with other people. I mean, that's what makes the world go around, working together. And I think it's so easy to try to foister our opinions or our thoughts on someone else as opposed to seeking first to understand and then to be understood. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me sometimes to sit back, someone saying something, I want to put my 2 cents worth in and make them understand and use that word again, as opposed to just sitting back and listening and quite possibly they have a very valid reason for doing what they're doing, and maybe the two ideas can come together synergistically and make an even better a better answer or what have you.
Exactly.
A lot of times you run into that, making the other person
see. You want to persuade.
Yes.
One of the biggest things. Yeah.
Hasn't it been ingenious of the Japanese method of producing cars? They brought the worker into making decisions and finding solutions so that they feel part of the team rather than being ordered.
Again, expanding that problem-solving surface, taking the opinion of the person that's, you know, on the line, that may be an inappropriate word for how they manufacture, but someone who's really involved with the nitty-grits of the operation. Exactly. Well, thanks for coming this morning. And if anyone's interested in pursuing this, I think it's 4:00 tomorrow. So,